Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad Corporation appellant versus Donald Jacobs, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Brian Donahoe, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Mr. Jacobs, we have Mr. Ronald A. Parsons, Jr., an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. Donahoe, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. We're here today to address an issue relating to the Federal Employers Liability Act, or FELA. I represent Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad, or DM&E, which has a rail yard located in Huron, South Dakota. In the case below, the circuit court found, as a matter of law, that the, quote, normal winter conditions, end quote, encountered by the plaintiff at the time of his accident were, in fact, sufficient to allow for the jury to determine foreseeability in this particular case under the FELA. In order for you to understand what normal winter conditions mean in this situation, which can vary from time to time and from location to location within South Dakota, I want to explain a little bit about the Huron Rail Yard and about what the people there do when they work for DM&E Railroad. Here, Mr. Jacobs was a person in the mechanical department. His job was to inspect rail cars and look for problems that may arise either in their operation or in the mechanical parts on those cars that are required for their safe use. And that means everything from checking on tanker cars or hazardous material cars to ensure that they have proper seals and meet all the federal requirements and regulations, and all of those mundane little things that can break on a rail car. He and other mechanical department employees work as a team, and all of them need to be able to inspect these rail cars and identify problems or defects or things that are just in need of repair because they're worn or may become a problem while the cars are in operation. In this particular instance, we're talking about a period of time in early January of 2007. It's a Sunday, January 7th, 2007 to be exact, and Mr. Jacobs goes to work that morning for the first time after being off for 2 days. Weather records that are in evidence in this case would indicate that there wasn't a major snow event and the weather had been moderate, meaning that there had been some temperatures into the low 30s and then cold at night. There was a small bit of snow and there was some blowing when Mr. Jacobs arrived. Now, it so happens that he appropriately got to work and put on what are called ice cleats to wear in his work that day. DM&E provides these ice cleats for the employees to wear over their work boots. And they're required to wear certain work boots, and they're required to be in charge of maintaining these personal protective clothing or other operational gear when they're out in the rail yard. And they and all of the other employees are also responsible to ensure that they are following the safety rules, which include rules that require them to look where they're going and to identify any unsafe conditions and to remedy them or report them right away. Here, the DM&E also had other precautions in place to assist the railroad employees who had to work outside to deal with the winter conditions. What we're talking about here is a process where the railroad would bring in an outside contractor and clear ice and snow when they had a storm event or when it was warranted because of the winter conditions. Here, that had been done sometime previous to January 7th, and in areas where vehicles would normally pass and go from one end of the rail yard to the other, which, by the way, is almost 4 miles east to west across the northern part of Huron. And it's basically bisected by the main street, which is also a state highway, Dakota Avenue, in downtown Huron. Mr. Jacobs and a fellow employee in the mechanical department, Kevin Walton, were going to work together that day. Going out in the rail yard, they had snow and blowing conditions, but it wasn't serious. It wasn't a ground blizzard or anything like that. In fact, it wasn't so bad, and Mr. Walton decided he wasn't going to wear his ice cleats, and so they went out together into the rail yard. In addition to clearing the snow with a contractor, the railroad also had designated areas where they knew that there would be employees that would have to work on the ground, and those were near switches. Switches are the mechanical components that will change rails from one track to another. They had salt and sand barrels there. And the employees also had a pickup truck for the mechanical department and a pickup truck for the transportation department, and those are the crew members who actually operate the trains. There was only about 7 people working in the rail yard that Sunday morning. Mr. Jacobs started his shift about 7 o'clock in the morning. They were out doing some things that day. He didn't perceive the conditions to be dangerous or in need of any kind of immediate attention, nor did Mr. Walton. In the course of their shift that morning, they went all the way across Dakota Avenue from a mechanical department shed from the east across Dakota Avenue to the west, and in the process of going to inspect a train, which was going to go out of the rail yard, they went all the way to the end on the west of the rail yard in the truck, and then on their way back, they encountered the train crew working on an end of railroad car marking device or end of car device. The train crew seemed to be having some problems there, and up until that point, neither Mr. Walton nor Mr. Jacobs had noticed anything that they thought was unusually dangerous or unsafe as far as these weather conditions go. They didn't slip or slide or anything like that in the pickup. They stopped the pickup, and instead of using the radio to communicate with them, which they had in the car, or I should say in the pickup, and the train crew would have had on their persons handheld walkie-talkie, instead of doing that, they decided that Mr. Jacobs was going to get out, walk over, and talk to the train crew. They parked the pickup. Mr. Jacobs walked over with no problems, talked to the train crew. It was determined that they were going to get a different rear-end marking device. Mr. Jacobs was going to go get it, and he was going to go walk back to the pickup, get in the pickup, drive over to where they were located, and get that for the crew. As he's walking back to the pickup, he encounters an area in a slightly different route than what he took going forward to the truck, or to the train crew, excuse me. On his way back to the truck, he takes a slightly different route, slips on some snow that actually has ice underneath it. He falls down, breaks his elbow. At the time, he didn't know it was broken. He just knew it was very painful. It turns out that he finished his shift that day, but in the process of doing so, he had a lot of pain. Pain didn't go away. He eventually went to the doctor. It was discovered it was a fractured elbow. He had to have pins placed in it. Unfortunately, because of the pins and the recovery period for the healing of the bone and the surgery required him to have that arm immobilized, he ended up with what's called frozen shoulder syndrome or adhesive capsulitis in that shoulder. That eventually led to the need for additional treatment and surgeries on the shoulder, which was over a period of time allowed him to return to work, but he's now got some permanent restrictions. I want to explain those restrictions briefly as well. The restrictions are that he cannot lift anything away from his body that would be more than 5 pounds. So if he's got his arm outstretched and he's going to try to lift something, he can't exceed 5 pounds. And just for your reference, that's about the weight of a gallon of milk. That's difficult to do without any restrictions. He also has some limitations on being able to raise his arm above his head, so he doesn't do work overhead with that arm. As a result of work hardening, physical therapy, and other things, and some things recommended by the railroad to assist him in getting back to work, he entered into an accommodation for his job, and he's now back doing the same job, but without having to do certain duties that other people will cover. What he does now entails what they call the order man type of job. That job has to be done no matter what. And when he's not there working, because he's got a day off or it's his weekend, somebody else has to cover that. But what he does is he checks on all the cars, does the inspections. He also does all of the ordering and entering into the records necessary for the railroad to track repairs that are made, who is to be billed, and how they are to be billed. As a result, Mr. Jacobs is now able to do the same things that he was doing before, except for a few restricted things as far as his physical activities, but he makes as much money as he did before. And the railroad paid for all of his medical expenses and gave him what's called wage continuation while he was off from work. Now, prior to the railroad being sued in this case, about 6 months after the actual accident, but while he was actually represented by counsel, Mr. Jacobs went out into the rail yard in August of 2007 and took pictures of areas that had a lot of standing water in them in the rail yard. At trial, that testimony about those pictures and the photographs was allowed over the objection of counsel for the railroad, and we were then later given a standing objection on any issues relating to drainage.
Did any of those pictures depict the spot where he actually fell?
No. Those pictures, he testified, showed the area approximately 150 to at least 200 feet away from the area where the accident happened.
So let me just make sure I understand. Were there pictures offered that showed where he fell?
Yes, they were taken at the time of the accident. What happened was after he fell in January of 2007, he reported the incident immediately to his supervisors, and what's called a three-man inspection took place where they did take photographs of the area depicting the snow and the ice underneath it. Now, these pictures are just of the area where he fell. They don't show the greater area in the rail yard. But because it was winter and there really wasn't anything unusual as far as a big area of ice or anything like that, this was a small patch, obviously as evidenced by the fact that he walked past it the first time and didn't hit it, and then only found it when he came back a slightly different route. So the inspection was simply of the area right where he fell. Now the trial court unfortunately misconstrued the standard for foreseeability and proximate cause in this case under the FELA, and basically determined that these normal winter conditions or anything relating to the weather would give rise to a jury question and furthermore would allow almost any kind of evidence related to anything that could possibly go towards the winter conditions or ice to be allowed as evidence in this case. It is very clear that even with that evidence, there is no foreseeability as a matter of law in this case, because nothing in this record ties any notice, constructive or actual notice, on the part of the railroad to the accident site itself. Instead, what we've got are these pictures of the drainage, which were highly prejudicial and confusing, which were, as Mr. Jacobs described it, 3 to 4 rail car lengths away from where he fell. A rail car is at least 50 feet long. That's 150 to 200 feet, as I stated before. Mr. Jacobs testified that he didn't see ice accumulating in that particular area before his accident. He'd been off for 2 days. So at least 3 days before, he hadn't seen any ice accumulating in that area. He had no reason to believe that ice was accumulating in that area on the day that the accident happened. His co-worker, Mr. Walton, didn't see any ice in that area either that day or the day before. Mr. Walton worked the day before. He described the area as being normal winter conditions.
And what did the plaintiff's expert say about ice in that area?
The plaintiff's expert also determined that anything that could possibly relate to ice or snow is enough for constructive notice. And he gave a very conclusory and ipsedixit opinion that if there was ice there, the railroad would have had enough time to remove it, period. His theory and his standard, in fact, was that the railroad had a duty to inspect the entire rail yard and remove all the ice and snow whenever there was the possibility that an employee might have to walk anywhere. And that's important to understand because we're talking about this 4-mile-long area, and where you have switches or where you would have a building that the employees have to go in every day or where you'd have a sidewalk or a paved area, you'd expect that the railroad would, in fact, remove all ice and snow. But we're talking about a gravel path, mainly used by pickup trucks in the rail yard.
So let me understand, you talk about where he was coming back and slipped, and you said it was a slightly different route.
Yes.
But was this a route that was ordinarily used by employees who walked to and from places?
This is an area that runs parallel to the railroad track itself. There is a train on the railroad track, and there are separate tracks further to the north. This is to the south. And so if you're familiar with Huron, this is to the west of Dakota, and it's in that area that would be normally used for the pickups to go from one end of the yard to the other. There's a train crew that is working on a train. Now, when these trains are made up or switched in the yard, they have to take cars from different places and put them into an order for a train to get them to a particular destination. So there's no way to tell exactly where the train would be or where a particular rail car would be in any given situation. No, this is not an area where there would regularly be foot traffic. And in fact, there's no reason why Mr. Jacobs had to walk there. He could have driven his pickup right up to the train crew.
Was there a contributory negligence claim?
There was a contributory negligence claim. There was an instruction to the jury. The jury found no contributory negligence. And that's one of the things that we are basing our foreseeability claim on. Not only was Mr. Jacobs authorized and empowered to tell his supervisors, I think it's unsafe, I think we need to get the contractor in, he could have also stopped right there if he didn't think it was safe, taken the pickup over to one of the sand and salt barrels, and gotten some sand and salt himself and spread it in the area where he thought it was unsafe, or told supervisors somebody needed to do that. Or he could have simply said, from what I see out here in the rail yard, things aren't as good as they need to be. And so, even though I'm wearing my ice cleats, I'm going to take the safest route here, and I'm going to use the radio and talk to people. I'm not going to get out and walk around.
I understood that all this ice was covered by snow.
That's correct, Justice Center. There was a skiff, as he called it, of snow over the top of this ice. And what happened was, apparently, there had been some freezing and thawing, and ice collected in a small area, and then the snow blew over the top of it. And so when he got out, he saw snow, he walked over it, and on his way back, actually encountered the snow, and he slipped and fell. Now, what's important to know here is that these ice cleats are pretty effective. There was absolutely no testimony whatsoever that there had been a history of anyone slipping and falling in that area, or that there had been a slip and fall prior to this accident with people wearing ice cleats out in the rail yard. This is something that is critical here because all the cases that were cited by a plaintiff in this appeal are situations where you either have an ironclad scenario where the employee has to walk there because it's the only ingress or egress for a building or a locomotive or some other piece of equipment, or it's a situation where you've got like a paved parking lot or a sidewalk where they would expect people to walk, or they've invited people to walk. Here, that's not the case. It may or may not be an area where someone may have to walk, but if they do have to walk, the railroad has provided ice cleats. That gets us to a point where, as a matter of law, as this court has recognized, foreseeability in a negligent situation, and the FELA is a negligent statute, it is comprised of two components, the scope of the legal duty and those factual questions that go to the reasonable person test. The scope of the legal duty, that's reviewed by this court de novo, and that's where the trial court erred, that's where the expert that they hired erred, and counsel down below erred on the plaintiff's side. They all argued, normal winter conditions, you know it's slippery out. You've got to get rid of anything that could cause a person to slip and fall because you know people have to be outside and working. That's backwards. Of course, the railroad knows that people might slip and fall if there are winter conditions out there and they have to work outside. But that's why they require them to wear the ice cleats. That's why they have the sand and salt barrels. That's why they have the ability to and the empowerment of the employees to say, it's not safe, call the contractor or do something else. That is not assumption of the risk. And we have cited cases in our reply brief that address this very thing. There's a case that says it is contributory negligence if the employee has one choice or another on the path that he takes in the snow, and he takes a path that's less safe.
Well, but that's the contributory negligence thing is not appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor. But
the question of duty, I mean, you're not suggesting there was no duty on the part of the railroad, are you?
What I'm suggesting is that the duty had been met. That's the McGivern case. And we've cited that extensively in our
breach. Isn't breach a fact question for the jury?
Absolutely not when you're talking about the scope of the duty. Here we have a situation where the McGivern case says very clearly where the railroad has a choice of separate operations or methods of dealing with these conditions that may or may not be unsafe. It's not for the court or the jury to second guess those decisions that are made so long as there is actually a method or a process put in place. What they say is that the decision of managing officers of doubtful questions relating to methods of operation or equipment are deemed to be presumptively right, and ordinarily they may not be made the foundation of liability to the employee.
Now, McGivern is nearly 70 years old. Do you have any more modern authority from this court to support your position?
Yes, I do, Justice. Chief Justice, excuse me. The McGivern case was examined by a case in 1964, also from the Eighth Circuit, and they determined that that was good law, and that is the Chicago Northwestern Transportation Company versus Regeer case. That is cited in footnote 8 on page 10 of our reply brief. And basically, what they say is that in these winter conditions, the weather may be a factor, but what you look at is the scope of the duty, and that's always a question of law for the court. And the scope of the duty can't be broadened beyond what is necessary for a reasonable railroad to respond to these weather conditions. So the question becomes, did they have something in place? Did they act in a way that is consistent with their duty in order to provide a safe workplace? In order to look at that and establish that there is a jury question, you've got to produce some evidence of two things for foreseeability, a temporal element, and beyond the temporal element, you've got to have, and this is for constructive notice, so I'm assuming that there's no actual notice, you've got to have temporal so that it's there sufficiently long enough that it's got a character that the railroad should have taken care of it. And then secondly, that it is also something that has a link to the things that the railroad would expect.
Your time has expired. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Donnell.
You.
Mr. Parsons, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Mr. Donahoe. This is a case that really involved life-changing injuries for Mr. Jacobs. He underwent three surgeries. He has lost much of the function in his dominant arm. And he spent about 15 months out of work, did more than a year of physical therapy, and his ability to perform his vocation has been forever altered.
Is federal regulation here the reason we're not dealing with a workman's comp issue?
I think so, yes, Your Honor. There's no there's no medical bills that are at issue in this FELA case. It's really just lost income and pain and suffering and those type of damages. The jury heard all the testimony and the evidence regarding exactly what happened and exactly what the notice was to the railroad regarding these conditions, what the standard was that it was supposed to meet. And there were 12 jurors, and 11 of them heard all that evidence and concluded that the duty had been breached, that they did not provide a reasonably safe workplace. One found for the defendant. So what we have here is a classic question of fact where you have disputed facts and competing inferences that are drawn from those facts, and that was resolved by the jury. And the standard here is abuse of discretion, viewing all these facts and inferences in the light most favorable to the jury verdict.
Just out of curiosity, why is this tried in Brookings County if the injury occurred in Huron?
I think you can file it where the defendant is also located, is my guess. I don't know that, but I think DM&E had a location in Brookings.
Can you address this foreseeability? That's something you struggle with, is whether it's a...
Sure.
Where is the line, and what do you look at to determine whether or not it's a question of law or a question for the jury of fact?
Well, the duty under FELA is clear. I mean, they have to provide a reasonably safe workplace, and if there's any negligence, and it's even a standard that courts have interpreted as even a lesser standard than negligence, if they were responsible in any way, in any part, for producing an injury caused by their employee, then they're responsible for that. And so what we had here, we had facts and expert testimony that showed what that duty was supposed to be. And here, it was not just, the claim has been summarized, I think, incorrectly by the railroad. It's not that they had a duty to remove all the snow from the railroad. Actually, what happened here, and the facts showed that you had about 0.3 inches of snow the night before. Very small amount of snow the night before. But the weather conditions had been such that it would get warm in the day and it would freeze at night. And you had water that was pooling in this area, obviously, because that night it turned into basically a sheet of ice, or probably for the last several nights, and who knows how long before that, there had been ice in this area. And even though it had only snowed about 0.3 inches the night before, they looked at it right after he fell. And there was about, according to the railroad's inspectors that looked at it, about 3 inches of snow over this area. And that's in Exhibit H2 and H3 is a couple of photographs. And you can see that there's a lot of snow. And what it's covering here, you can see where he slipped. It's covering, basically, I think the testimony was about a 20 by 30 sheet of, looks like, black ice. And this is an area that also the pictures show, Exhibit 13, the various pictures, where it's a gravel road, and it's an access road, and trucks drive on here, but also the carmen, what Mr. Jacobs was, he walks, and they all walk along this road, you know, for a couple of miles inspecting all the cars. So they go up on the rocks and look at the cars, and they walk across this all the time. And they talk to people there. I mean, the testimony was that people are in this railway walking on a daily basis, every day. And he's walking along here is where he fell. And you can see even here there's pooling water. There was,
is this one of the exhibits that's challenged?
Yeah, I wanted to clarify that because Exhibit 13, 1, shows pictures of where he fell. I mean, we have two sets of three pictures. Exhibit 13-1, according to page 71 of the trial testimony, the question was, is this the area where he fell, referring to 13-1? Yes, sir. And this is where he fell. And so these pictures showed where he fell. It was about 8 months afterwards. But it shows that water does pool there, and you know the topography doesn't change with the temperature. When that's frozen and there's frozen water and snow is melted and refroze, that can be slippery. And there was a sheet of ice here. Now, the pictures that were objected to are 13-9. These are other pictures in the railway that don't show where he fell. And those were admitted, but the jury was told what each picture was. I mean, there was no misleading of the jury. These were other parts of the yard that also had pooling. And the actual objection that Mr. Donahoe made was that the objection was, quote, they show areas, these pictures, in addition to the accident area. So the jury saw the accident area, and this is a close-up of where he fell in the winter. So their expert testimony was that you have to, people are walking here all the time, all day, every day. It's not an area where people don't walk. The carmen have to be there. And so you have to take some measures to make sure that you're dealing with the snow and the ice. And here we have about 3 inches of snow over a sheet of ice where people walk and where Mr. Jacobs was walking doing his job. I mean, he wasn't out of position. And the railroad expert that testified for Mr. Jacobs, or one for us and one for the railroad, they looks like they go against each other all the time, and they both vouched for each other's credentials. They both have run railroad yards. And he said, you have to have a program in place that's proactive. What you have to do is have someone regularly come and clean the areas where you know people are going to be walking all the time every day. And when you know there's the possibility of ice, particularly when there's melting and refreezing water, you have to have some kind of sanding and salting or chemical treatment program. And the testimony here was that there was no proactive program for these access roads, for these areas where the carmen and the inspectors walk.
Was this all 4 miles of this yard they were supposed to do every day?
Well, they're supposed to have some kind of program, not necessarily every day, but some kind of program where they do regular salting and sanding. I mean, cities salt the entire road of towns is salted before I get up in the morning in Sioux Falls usually. What you just have to do is about testimony was about $200. You can put something on the back of a pickup truck and drive it along the road, and it spreads salt and sand if it's slippery. But it was not just that they didn't have a proactive program. The testimony was that they would call if there was a need, or that if someone pointed out a hazardous position, then they would do something. So the standard is, that was testified by our expert, was it has to be a proactive program. There was also notice. I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
There was also substantial evidence of notice in this case. You had a supervisor, the testimony, Mr. Mills, the yard supervisor, the day before on page 258, 273 through 275 of the transcript, The day before the accident, he said, "The yard is icy and slippery." He warned everybody. He said, "So much so that I lost control of my truck and almost hit another truck. And, quote, something should be done about this." That's the day before. You had, as the testimony was, about 0.3 inches of snow that night, but there was about 3 inches covering the sheet of ice. So that's constructive notice. This is where people are all the time.
Right. Can we go back to, you're saying the foreseeability is a question of law. Mr. Donahue's saying, wait a minute, you're saying it's a question of fact. Mr. Donahue's saying it's a question of law. And I guess the second part of that, on the contributory negligence, this is a Federal Employee Liability Act, and contributory negligence, that's a whole other thing in that law, and that's not an issue here.
Right, it's not been appealed, and the jury said there was no contributory negligence.
Which, that's, generally that's not a factor anyway in these type of cases. Well, I guess it's not an issue anyway, so we
not
don't
here.
Have to worry about that. But.
Right. The question of duty is always a question of law, but it's what is the duty? What is the standard you have to meet? The facts tell you whether or not you breached it, and the facts here establish that they did not provide a reasonably safe workplace here. And there are many cases we've cited in our brief where if you don't sand and you leave sheets of ice where employees walk every day, you don't have any sanding, salting program to take care of that. That, and someone falls because of that, because ice was obscured by 3 inches of snow.
So was
many
the,
cases
was
the supporting
duty birth. And the foreseeability as part of the legal issue on the duty. Was that offered through the experts?
Experts and fact testimony. The expert also talked about how there was pooling in these areas in all over the yard, but we know we have pooling because we have ice, a sheet of ice. And so, I mean, it's a fact there's standing frozen water at the place where he fell. And there was also trial testimony from Mr. Walton, who was a co-worker, who said, yeah, we had drainage problems in this yard. And the expert testified about deposition testimony that he relied upon and that the railroad's expert also relied upon in giving his opinions, that there were drainage problems in this yard.
This kind of foreseeability or duty issue for railroads, there's a whole body of law just talking about that, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a
it's
whole
kind of a unique area. I mean, it's different than what we would normally see here on the duty to clean off ice and so forth.
That's true. That's true. But there's lots of instances. There's no rule. I mean, it seems like there's trying to be a cookie cutter rule applied to this case. It's a factual investigation as to did they breach their duty? Was this negligent? I mean, that's a classic jury question. I mean, and that's what we had here.
But
competing,
you know,
inferences.
As I hear counsel for the appellant, they're trying to draw a distinction between the scope of a duty and the existence of a duty, saying that scope is still a legal question, and that wasn't met here.
Yeah, I disagree with that. This is an area where the testimony, you know, I could cite all over the record, where, and even their expert admitted, this is a place, Mr. Doyle, the railroad's expert, this is a place where they walk all the time. And if it's a place where they walk all the time, that's included in the scope of the duty to make sure where they're walking is safe. And the testimony was that they breached that duty because they left it uncleared, 3 inches of snow over a sheet of ice, with no salting or sanding program at all for this area. Only if someone called and said, "I see a danger, now go fix it." It was a reactive program. And they did have barrels of salt by the switching stations where there's a heavy traffic. But there's no dispute that there's plenty of traffic in these roadways, and they just need to at least salt and sand. They can't leave obscured sheets of ice covered by 3 inches of snow where their carmen walk. And a jury is free to conclude that that breached the standard of care in this case, FELA standard of care, which is a very light burden.
Can I switch gears just a little bit? Although this wasn't argued orally, it's certainly in the briefs, that about the special verdict form as opposed to a general verdict form.
Yes.
Are we at the point where we need to say that it's reversible error not to give it when it's requested?
I don't think so. There's certainly no case law that would indicate that.
But we've also in many cases said, if you don't ask for it, we can't look behind it. Here it was asked for.
It was asked for. That's true. It's this court has always held it's a matter of discretion with the trial judge, and I don't see an abuse of discretion here. The jury was instructed on all the elements, the jury found that the defendant was negligent. That's probably 80 to 90% of the verdicts I see in the state of South Dakota are that same way. They don't parse out each element of an offense, and that can be very confusing. So I would urge the court not to adopt a rule like that for liability or damages. But here, I don't think there's any basis to conclude that Judge Gienap abused his discretion in saying, was the defendant negligent on these claims? Was the plaintiff contributory negligent? Yes, he was. No, the plaintiff wasn't, and these are the damages.
So the only thing that really wasn't specific was the elements of the damages.
Right. And, we haven't had argument on that today, but I'm happy to answer any questions about the damages. They were fully supported by the record, and there was a vocational expert that testified to his loss of earning capacity. One thing I could say generally about the verdict form is, and the verdict, it was a $300,000 verdict, but we had many elements of damages. There was a $40,000 at least past wage loss. And then we have a person who has undergone, three surgeries, a year off of work, a year of physical therapy, and significant limitations in what he can do with his dominant arm. He really can't be a mechanic anymore. This is a person who's always outside working on cars, climbing all over rail cars. He can't climb ladders. He can't bend down and get under things. He can't do the things that he used to do. And so the jury gave a general verdict of $300,000. But, that could be all explained to his pain and suffering. For me, that's a conservative verdict. I think you can get to $300,000 before you ever even get to loss of earning capacity.
Could you address the notice of review issue, the offset?
Thank you, Your Honor. I did want to.
Why shouldn't the railroad be entitled to an offset?
I think in many cases they are, but I think this case they aren't, and this is why. I think the statute that allows them, and this is a question of law, the only question of law other than the tax issue in the whole case, the interest issue, I'm sorry, Section 45 U.S.C. 55, we've only had the second part of that statute cited in the briefing and in the judge's decision, but the purpose of that statute is to make sure that the railroad can't do anything to void its FELA liability. So it says that any attempt for a carrier to exempt itself from any liability created by this chapter shall to that extent be void. And then there's an exception, and that's what we're talking about here. The exception is if they may set off any sum that it has contributed or paid to any insurance, relief benefit, or indemnity that may have been paid to the injured employee or the person entitled thereto on account of the injury or death for which the action was brought. And so that's what's called a set-off. So here, normally, if there is a disability plan, so a person gets disability benefits when they're injured, the Clark case in the Eighth Circuit really goes through the history of this very well, and both parties have cited that. They do get a deduct for that. But it's different here. The case also makes sure you have to look at the specific provisions of the plan and look at what the damages were for. And in this case, this was a waive. We weren't given the plan. The court note mentions in its decision the railroad never gave me this plan so I could look at its policies. But it's what it really is a wage continuation plan. So he was paid about $16,000 in wages that he was supposed to receive anyway if he had been working. He wasn't working, but he got these $16,000 in wages. Now, the damages claim that we had for past wages was the difference between what he was paid and what he was not paid, what he should have been paid. And so the W-2s that were put into evidence would have included his wage continuation. The $16,000 would have been included in what he was paid as reflected in the W-2s. And so we asked for the difference, what he lost, what he wasn't paid. And so our argument here is that they're getting a double benefit. It's really double dipping. They got a credit for the $16,000 because he didn't claim that in his damages claim. And then they're getting an additional $16,000 off the verdict. Now, the other point about this, though, it's hard to tell all that because it was a general verdict. So we don't know what part of the verdict was for wages and what part wasn't. And so,
but the railroad did ask for that. They asked for an itemization. Say that there's no abuse of discretion in saying denying it, aren't we? That's just kind of a conundrum here because now the railroad can't prove that there was a credit or not a credit, or either way.
Well, but our claim is it was not even asked for because we didn't ask for what he was paid. We just asked for the difference between what he was paid on the W-2s and what he would have made if he hadn't been. But there is a little bit of a problem there. But I don't think that should be held against the verdict. And the judge decided as a matter of law that they were entitled to a setup, and I just don't think there's a basis for that, particularly when the plan's not in the record. So we would ask that the court affirm this jury verdict on damages and liability, but we would ask you to take a look at the $16,000 issue because as a question of law, I'm not sure they showed that they were entitled to that set-off.
Doesn't that create sort of a chilling effect? I mean, we want if a railroad employee is injured, we do want the railroad to continue to make their pay. There's an incentive to do that if they get a set-off. But if now we say, well, the railroad is not going to get it because they didn't get an itemized verdict, are we not chilling the possibility there that employees are going to be protected when they're injured?
That's a possibility. We want to encourage the railroad to do this. I certainly agree with that. I think in this case, it wouldn't do so in this specific case, but that's something we'll leave to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Donahoe, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I want to pick up on those last questions and start there. In regard to the policy or the encouragement of the railroad to provide these kinds of benefits, that is exactly why the set-off is allowed. In addition, that's also why the economic loss that was hotly contested in this case needs to be addressed by this court. We needed a special verdict form that broke down everything, not just the elements for negligence, but also the damages, and itemize those things because it was disputed that there was any past wage loss because we had provided the wage continuation.
Now, did you argue to the jury that he had been paid that $16,000 and that they should not include that?
No, Your Honor, we did not because there was no evidence that was clear as to exactly what they were calculating their past wage loss on.
And you didn't present anything either?
No, Your Honor. What happened was Mr. Jacobs was presented his W-2s by his counsel, and they tried to walk him through it, and he basically said, I don't understand it. My wife takes care of the money. And then his wife testified, and she really couldn't explain it either. But what we did was we walked her through it, and she testified that, yes, he's making as much money as he did before. He's really not making anything different from what he had before because he's also got the cost of living benefit increases. So he was made whole. That was our position. In addition, we also argued through every part of this trial, including their vocational rehabilitation expert, that he had been accommodated. And the policies behind the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Railway Labor Act that encourage people to actually treat folks who may have some kind of a medical restriction or a perceived disability or actual disability as being able to do work should be encouraged in this kind of a case. You can't reward somebody by offering and then giving them $300,000, exactly what the closing argument by the plaintiff said was the future wage loss based on the difference between what he was making, what he is making for the railroad, and what he would have to make if he wasn't working for the railroad and only got $7.25 to $10 per hour. That was hotly contested. It was an abuse of discretion by the trial court not to itemize the categories of damages so we could assess that for two reasons, and I'm going to run out of time here, so I'm just going to touch on this briefly. But if you look in the transcripts that we have cited in our reply brief, you'll see exactly how closing argument calculated that amount, and it was exactly $300,000, $20,000 a year times 15 years expected work life till he's a little over 65. That was their calculation. And it was all based on earning capacity. It's impossible to have a loss of earning capacity when he's back in the same job he had before. He's got seniority, and he says that's the reason why I might lose it, because somebody might bump me, and we established through cross-examination that, no, it's an accommodation. And we used the words accommodation. We talked about those things under the Americans with Disabilities Act that would be, in fact, for the court to take judicial notice. His vocational rehabilitation expert said he's been accommodated. His surgeon said he can do this job until he retires with these accommodations. He's not going to leave this job. If he does leave this job, what he did in the previous employment was a welder. If you're going to calculate these things, you're going to have to do it based on the difference between what he made as a welder and what he would be making at these minimum wage jobs, not what he's making on the railroad. That's not fair, because if he doesn't work for the railroad, it's his own choice or factors beyond the control of the railroad, which have nothing to do with his alleged disability or restrictions.
Doesn't this go to the jury instruction question, though, on how to calculate damages?
That instruction, we're not contesting, Aaron. What we're contesting is that we can show clearly that that is unsupported by the evidence and should not have been given. If you had evidence to support that, the instruction itself might be appropriate. Furthermore, if you are going to give that instruction and it's hotly contested like this and it's an evolving area of the law where we just have new amendments to the Americans with Disabilities Act and we've got confusing testimony and a real chance that the jury's not going to understand this, you've got to itemize the elements of damage. Furthermore, if you look at their evidence here, going back to the abuse of discretion that they claim in the special verdict form and in some of the other instructions, proximate cause has not changed. It's common law proximate cause. It's not relaxed under FELA. That's the case decided by the Supreme Court. I shouldn't say decided. That's the case that the court indicated has not changed. That's the Sorrell case that we've cited. It's right now before the United States Supreme Court in McBride. CSX Transportation versus McBride. It was argued in March. It'll be decided this term by the U.S. Supreme Court. There is nothing under the Federal Employers Liability Act that changes the proximate cause standard from common law. That's important to understand because the judge got buffaloed. That's what happened down below in the circuit court. He let everything in. He relaxed the causation standard. It wiped out foreseeability. Foreseeability requires that not only that there's enough time to know that there is a particular defect or something wrong out there, but it's got to be location specific when you're talking about a rail yard. That's where it comes into play here as a matter of law. There's zero evidence from Mr. Walton, Mr. Mills, these phony depositions that they rely on, because the drainage issue that they're talking about isn't in this area. They didn't put those witnesses on.
We've got kind of a fact dispute here, which we don't usually try to resolve at this level, but as I understand it, now Mr. Parsons says Exhibit 13-1 does show the area that he was walking, and there is some drainage. Looked to me, I mean, just from his lifting it up, that there were some drainage issues there.
Let me address that. Those are 6 months later, without any explanation as to how much rain was received right before those photographs were taken. Those photographs, in addition to the other ones, were objected to, and again, we had a standing objection as to drainage. They do depict an area that no one can dispute is in the rail yard. The dispute is that we can't tell from the photographs as to exactly where his accident happened, because nobody marked that out. Mr. Jacobs testified to that. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and view that as if the jury decided it that way. That's what we must do on appeal. What the issue really becomes then is, are those conditions in August of 2007 anything like what they were in January of 2007? And furthermore, it's not 30 feet. That's the fact. Mr. Jacobs himself said it was 10 feet by 20 at the most. And importantly, it's not a sheet of ice that is obscured by snow. It's not black ice. It's ice that has developed over what has to have been a relatively short period of time, because Mr. Walton testified that he hadn't seen it, and there's no evidence, as admitted by their own experts, there's no evidence that anyone ever noticed ice in this area prior to the accident. If we're talking about this drainage problem and all these other issues relating to the alleged slipping around or problems that would give constructive notice, you've got to look at the actual facts here. Even looking at them with reasonable inferences that could be drawn by the jury, we don't get to location-specific foreseeability. That's what the cases say, and we've spelled that out in our reply brief. But critically, on page 167 of the transcript from the trial, Mr. Jacobs himself says he talked to Doug Mills, and he's the one who heard Mr. Mills talk about slipping in the rail yard. Mr. Jacobs wasn't working the day before, so we know Mr. Mills' alleged slip had to have happened the morning of the accident. Jacobs slipped at the beginning of the shift, the beginning of the day, and he doesn't even know where Mr. Mills slipped or slided in that rail yard. It may have had nothing to do with this location at all. That's not a fair inference to draw to say that the railroad should have known that there was ice where he was going to slip and fall. And in regard to the area and it being a walkway, it's not. This is an area for vehicle travel. Yes, it is possible that people might have to walk there, but it is not expected. And it's a gravel path or walkway or road, whatever you want to call it. The reference to paved streets being sanded and salted before people get up in the morning is ridiculous. You don't salt gravel roads. Anybody who lives out in the country like I do knows that they don't salt them, period. Railroads can't be held to some standard that's equal to what you do in town or what you do for the parking lot at Walmart. That's the legal scope that we're arguing was exceeded in this case. The railroad's being held to a higher standard. Finally, I need to talk about the fact that this area allegedly was not subject to a proactive process or program by the railroad. That's not a factual question that goes to the jury for two reasons. First of all, they got the ice cleats. In every single case that says you have to be proactive and address weather conditions in a rail yard says you have to provide something. Look at McGivern. It says you have to provide something at a minimum to address those things. And if you do that, then that's the scope of the duty that's required under the FELA. Then later on, cases interpreting that say it's still good law. And furthermore, they had a choice there of several different things that could have been done. And when the employee complained that they didn't do enough, they said, look, it's common law. You can look at several different cases. Under the FELA, the railroad is not required to provide the latest, greatest, best, or safest tools or equipment.
Your time has expired.
Thank you,
Mr. General. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.